From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Today, North Korean leader Kim Jong-un and his government released a statement on the state-run Korean Central News Agency, warning that they will take physical action against the newest UN sanctions. The sanctions are meant to curb North Korea's nuclear program by cutting about $1 billion from the country's export economy. UN Ambassador Nikki Haley spoke on Fox News today about the hoped-for impact on Kim's leadership.
This kicks him in the gut. This goes right after the hard currency. He's going to feel it. And all that money that he's been using for his ballistic missile program, you know, and he's not feeding his people, it just got reduced in a big way.
Perhaps. But today we also heard from Japan's defense ministry, which warned in a new report that North Korea's nuclear program has entered a new stage and that it's possible they've already acquired nuclear warheads. Joining us now by Skype, sanctions expert Anthony Ruggiero, senior fellow at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies. And Anthony, your thoughts on North Korea's threat of physical action against the newest sanctions?
Well, it sounds like they're taking notice. I think that North Korea at times has claimed that sanctions will never hurt them. But this is, you know, a very typical response by North Korea. These are sanctions that could start to impact their revenue streams.
Yeah, they're against iron ore, coal, seafood. Will it really impact the government and its nuclear program, or again, just continue to hurt the people?
Well, I mean, sanctions hurt the people because North Korea, if they do, because North Korea chooses that. North Korea is the one that all of the revenue that comes in, they spend on their programs, they spend on their military, they spend on luxury goods for their elite. They don't spend it for their people. So it's really a choice that North Korea makes.
Yeah. Well, and of course, the U.S. has to hope that it makes the right choice. What do you think about the, you know, Japan Defense Ministry's warning that North Korea doesn't just have the missiles that can go a longer distance, but may have the warheads that can go on the missiles?
Well, I think that's a prudent way to look at it. North Korea has been working on weaponization at least for the last 20 years, has been working on their program for at least double that before then. So I think it's an accurate assumption or assessment that they have the miniaturization to put on ballistic missiles.
Well, yesterday, a Chinese foreign minister said that they are willing to take the economic impact of increased sanctions with North Korea. But, you know, talking about what happens going forward, we've heard speculation that perhaps North Korea is looking over at Iran and saying, well, wait a second. Iran went through talks. Iran gave up its nuclear weapon capability in exchange for having some sanctions lifted. And now the current administration, the Trump administration, has made some noise about maybe walking back on some of that. If North Korea looks over at Iran, will they feel motivated to enter talks?
Well, I think North Korea has plenty of its own examples of essentially fleecing the other five parties for inducements to give up its nuclear weapons program and then have no intention of doing so. The North Koreans are frankly, have a PhD in doing that. So I think they've done it since 1994. And I think it's probably the other way where Iran is looking to North Korea and seeing, well, you know, we can get these inducements. And then, at some point, even if Iran abided by the deal, they could come out at the tail end with a relationship with North Korea that could get them closer to a nuclear weapons program. This is really more about whether North Korea is ready to denuclearize. And if we believe the foreign minister in Manila, the North Korean foreign minister in Manila, they have no intention of doing so.
I'm still struck by the North Korean statement today that there will be physical action. What might that be?
Well, North Korea is very dangerous. I think people forget that, you know, it's only 7 years ago that they used presumably one of their submarines to sink a South Korean Navy vessel that killed over 40 South Korean sailors and shortly thereafter shelled a South Korean island. So I think they're more dangerous than they let off. I mean, it's one thing to have missile tests, but North Korea has been prone to lash out. So I think we have to be on the lookout for those type of actions.
Well, we heard you say you feel more sanctions, just more squeezing of North Korea. Given how unstable the leadership is there any possibility of going in the opposite direction?
when we look at the options for dealing with North Korea, we remain in the diplomacy and or sanctions. The only real way forward is to combine the two. And that's why I suggested that Secretary Tillerson should have met with the North Korean foreign minister. I don't think that would have been a good conversation for North Korea, because I think Secretary Tillerson should have been very clear with him about the types of sanctions that are coming. But in terms of negotiations at this point, the United States does not have the leverage to get the deal that we need. And this is what we learned with Iran, that it took a robust sanctions campaign to bring Iran to the point where it was ready to make concessions. You know, and there are different opinions on the nuclear deal, but at least everybody, even critics, agree that it's sanctions that got the leverage and got to the eventual deal.
That's sanctions expert Anthony Ruggiero, senior fellow at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies. Anthony, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, now to a danger lurking in your kitchen sink. There's been a lot of attention over the last week or so on sponges after a new study revealed that your kitchen sponge is teeming with microbes. Researchers in Germany took samples from 14 used kitchen sponges, identified the microbes living in them, and created a map of how those microbes are distributed within the sponges. We're joined now by Massimiliano Cardinale, one of the authors of the study. He's a research associate in the Institute for Applied Microbiology at the Justus Liebig University in Germany. He joins us by Skype. Massimiliano, how full of microbes are used kitchen sponges?
Really full. Really full, more than we expected.
Like what? Tell us about what kind of things are living in these sponges.
So basically, the sponge can be seen as a complex habitat where several microbes live in. We concentrated our study on bacteria because from the diversity point of view, the bacteria are the more interesting, and from the metabolic point of view, they are also the more rich, and also because they might represent a threat for humans, because as you know, there are a lot of good bacteria, but also a few of quite nasty ones.
Like what? What are the nasty ones that live on these sponges?
Actually, we thought that we would detect typical pathogens like Salmonella or Campylobacter. What we found was really surprising. We could not even detect this kind of bacteria, but we found a really massive contamination by another category called opportunistic pathogens. These are species which are usually not dangerous for healthy people, but they might cause infections and diseases in people with a compromised or a weak immune system.
Does it make a difference if you use antibacterial soap on your sponge? Does that kill these things?
Actually, we demonstrated or we observed that it does not really help. And we explain this because such bacteria are very resistant to stress conditions. And this is what makes them also dangerous for us. And this means that when people try to disinfect or sanitize the sponge at home, what they are really doing is select the most resistant bacteria that will survive. And after that, they will fast colonize the sponge again.
Is it the same for people who put their sponge in the dishwasher or put their sponge in the microwave? Do those things help?
In our study, we had sponges that were cleaned with special products. We had sponges that were regularly treated by microwave radiation. And we could not find a difference in the amount of bacteria, but concerning the type of bacteria, we found that the regularly sanitized sponges had more opportunistic pathogens. So it could be even worse.
Hmm.
Not only it doesn't help, but it could really
makes it worse. So what are people supposed to do with this information? I mean, we have to be able to clean our dishes still, don't we?
Yes, exactly. Probably sponge is not a used sponge is not the most appropriate tool to clean the dishes. Perhaps a dishwasher is better. What we can suggest is avoid to make this domestic sanitation, because we still don't know exactly why, but it seems that it doesn't work. Probably it's better to have a replacement rate, which is a little bit more frequent.
Like how often would you replace your sponge?
I would avoid to keep a sponge longer than, so let's say, 10 days.
That's Massimiliano Cardinale, who is a research associate in the Institute for Applied Microbiology at the Justus Liebig University in Germany. He's one of the authors of a study on the microbes that live on used kitchen sponges, which we will link you to at hereandnow.org. Massimiliano, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for calling me.
Congratulations to the national champion, Texas Longhorn!
On ESPN and also ABC, John Saunders was a top sportscaster. He also had a loving wife, Wanda, two daughters, Aaliyah and Jenna, and a cloud of depression that often kept him in bed sobbing. Was it years of brutal abuse by his father? Head injuries? John was one of the few black hockey players in Canada where he grew up. As a kid, he tried drugs to stave depression off. As an adult, he considered suicide, walking right up to the railing of a well-known bridge. But then in 2011, John Saunders passed out on the ABC college football set, probably low blood sugar, and he incurred a serious brain injury, which led him on a journey. He and co-author John Bacon put that journey into book form, but last August, John Saunders passed away from natural causes at 61. Well, now the book has been published, still in John's voice. It's titled Playing Hurt, My Journey from Despair to Hope, and co-author John Bacon joins us from Michigan Radio in Ann Arbor. John, welcome back to Here and Now.
Thank you, Robin.
And we'd like to welcome for the first time Wanda Saunders, John's widow. She's at the NPR studios in New York. Just want to say how awful to get through all of those landmines that seemed planted in John's path. And he'd come to a place where, as the doctors promised, the depression was lifting, medication was working, and he collapses. The will was there, but the body couldn't carry on. So sorry for your loss.
Thank you very much.
Yeah. It seems as if his life was a gift because of all the times he thought of taking it.
Yes, very much so. And making it through and finding some hope somewhere to keep going.
John Bacon, tell us more about John Saunders.
He was a great athlete. He played hockey at the University of Michigan and Western Michigan and Ryerson University in Toronto. He played minor league hockey in New Brunswick. His brother, Bernie, made it to the NHL. He started his career in broadcasting on a lark as Country John Saunders on a tiny little radio station in Ajax, Ontario, and decided that he liked it, and he's actually very good at that. And within a few years, he's in Baltimore, and in 86, ESPN picks him up, along with Wanda, of course. They got married shortly thereafter. And John, for 30 years, was considered one of the top four or five sportscasters in the nation and covered every event you can name, Super Bowl, Olympics, you name it. So his career was beyond reproach, and the respect he had in the business is really quite uncommon because he was opinionated, he was not afraid to express himself, especially on race, and yet I cannot find to this day anybody who did not like John Saunders.
Well, and I just want to mention the one thing I left out of the many challenges he faced was racism. When he came from Canada to the U.S. to go to college, his first college roommate walked in and said, I'm not going to room with an N-word. And coming from Canada, he hadn't felt that. Wanda, he also hid. I mean, this abuse, we're not talking about a demanding sports parent. This was abusive. His father would throw baseballs at him way too hard. When John was a kid, he was terribly burned by a bottle rocket. His dad made him play hockey, blood soaking through his uniform. Other parents were horrified. It was so bad that John would try to shift the pain, I guess, from feeling so worthless to his skin. He would heat up old hangers and press the wire hangers into his skin and, you know, mutilate himself. But he didn't tell you about this at first. This was a secret.
No, I didn't know. There were not a lot of things in the book that I didn't know about, but there were a few, and that is one of them.
Oh, you didn't even know that?
No.
Wow. He thought it was his fault.
Yes, he always blamed himself. There has to be a reason why, so it must be me. And he carried that with him quite a while.
I mean, this is a family that didn't have anything to eat. And, you know, I'm wondering, too, John Bacon, a co-author mm-hmm. with John Saunders, part of what he did to alleviate that pain when he was young was pick a lot of fights, and his father also beat him. I'm sure the brain injuries started then.
I'm sure you're right. And the catch to concussions, or what doctors called brain injuries, is that if you think you had 10, you probably had 20. And then, of course, finally on September 10th, 2011, he blacks out, falls backwards, and John's a big guy. That was a very major brain injury, which put him into Mount Sinai for 6 weeks to relearn how to walk and talk and read and write.
Well, and so there are these two parallel stories, John Bacon. There's the how to recover from a brain injury, which John Saunders lays out beautifully. We go through his rehab with him. But Wanda, with you, we're learning how you deal with depression and how you deal with this childhood abuse, which doesn't end because you're an adult. His sister Gail also struggled with depression, died in 2000. She took an overdose of her antidepressants. Her mom was there and went out to run some errands. You were there with John when this was confirmed to him, and he had to admit that his mother was not there for them either.
All three kids did have to struggle with both parents. It's difficult when you don't have that one person to go to. It's hard.
Yeah. Well, and how did that affect him as a father? You know, this is, again, another story.
Not at all.
Not at all? He was afraid it would, though.
Well, when we first met each other, I just knew, well, we're not going to have kids. He doesn't want to have kids. He doesn't think he's going to be a good father. But then we did, and I would say my girls are the luckiest girls in the world.
He learned he was not the cause of his father's horrific problems, whatever they were. And he was not his father.
Yes.
Or his mother.
Right.
Look, talk about the depression, Wanda. I mean, for people who think it's just, a bad mood, what was it like?
It feels like being sad when you don't have anything to be sad about and not being able to stop it.
And thinking the worst. His thoughts were
Yes.
The girls are going to college. Oh, wait, they're leaving forever.
Yes, everything was the 10th degree as opposed to, you know, one or two.
Almost everything turns negative, the worst possible interpretation of everything that happens to you. He also said, too, that when you get good news, praise and whatnot, your metabolism runs a lot higher and you burn through that very quickly. You need a lot more reinforcement than somebody else does. And I think that's a legacy of the child abuse, frankly.
Well, that's what becomes so clear. It's something that's stalking him. It's not always there.
That's right. Yeah. Exactly. One phrase we came up with is the world goes to black and white. You still have a loving wife. You still have wonderful daughters. And I cannot say enough about what Wanda and Ali and Jenna did for John. They kept him going, no question. But they can't always reach you when you're that down. You need to get professional help. And John did. John was, you know, winning this battle bit by bit.
But before that, the combination of a fall, which may have been because of low blood sugar, the diabetes he'd learned he had, and then striking his head in the concrete, the combination of now coming back from a brain injury and having depression, a double whammy. He knew that the head injury and the depression were going to mess with each other and come back thoughts of suicide, even a trip to a bridge that I don't want to mention, frankly.
Right.
I can add this point, by the way. The guy who made the diagnosis, if you will, that it was more than just a concussion that John was dealing with and all that, it was Reggie Jackson, who happens to be Wanda's uncle, and staying at their house. And he just went to Wanda and said, something is not right with John beyond the brain injury. And it was Reggie Jackson who confronted John in a car. And as John said, there's no BSing Mr. October. So through Reggie Jackson's connections at Columbia, John got a new set of doctors. And these proved to be, I think, his best.
Well, at one point, he's in the psychiatric ward. You know, he looks up and says, whoa, I am a part of this community because his doctors felt rightly that he was suicidal.
Yes.
He's John Saunders.
I know. One of the scariest times in my life. And I'm a very open person. So we just, whatever he was feeling, I listened. And if I could help, I would help. But I think it's more important that he was able to just tell me whatever he was feeling while he was going through this process of being in the hospital. So I think it's just the two of us just being able to talk to each other and me not thinking that I can solve everything for him or help him through it. Mm. It's something that he had to go through himself.
Wanda, what do you hope people take from this terrific book?
I hope that it helps somebody. I hope it helps somebody understand what they're going through or make it a little easier for them. I hope that people realize that you can't just suck it up and be happy, that you do need to get help. And I hope everybody really understands what a good person he was and how much he cared about other people and wanted to help them.
And there are 30 million people in America with clinical depression. So he wanted to help those folks as well as folks who love them.
Oh, I tell you, just to hear of the wonderful things that happened at the end of his life, Wanda, the surprise parties that you and his brother could give him with hundreds of friends coming and, you know, the trips.
By the way, that was a great party, Robin.
Oh, well, you were there. Well,
I was absolutely there. So it was Robin Roberts and Charles Barkley and guys from high school in Chateauguay, Montreal.
Yeah,
so.
You do, Wanda, get to see that if, as his doctors promised him, if you stick with the medication, it takes some time, but at least you had that time.
Yes.
And Wanda, you, I'm assuming, could have changed this book. You could have taken out the terrible, I mean, he also raised his fists and we became his father's son for a while. You could have taken out the suicide attempts. You didn't. Why?
Because I know how important this was to him and I know how hard he worked on it and it gave him a sense of accomplishment and that he will hopefully help somebody. And I couldn't take that away from him. I know he can't say anything to me if I hadn't, but I know that it was very, very important to him. I just wanted to do it for him.
Well, you have. The book is Playing Hurt, My Journey from Despair to Hope, co-written by the late sportscaster John Saunders with our friend John Bacon. And we've also been speaking to Wanda Saunders, John's widow. John, Wanda, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Robin.
Today, voters in Kansas City, Missouri are weighing in on whether to raise that city's minimum wage to $10 an hour. It's currently $7.70. But regardless of the outcome, it's not clear that today's vote will have any effect on wages because of a new state law passed by the Republican-controlled state legislature that makes it illegal for cities to raise their minimum wage higher than the state's, which is $7.70 an hour. Brian Ellison is a host and contributor at KCUR in Kansas City, Missouri. He joins us now. Hi, Brian.
Good to be with you, Jeremy.
So this all started in May when St. Louis passed a measure raising the minimum wage there to $10. Why did the legislature decide to act in response to that?
Well, there's a conflict between those who support sort of local control, the freedom of individual cities to make these decisions, and a state government that for the last several years has been dominated by Republicans in the legislature and now with a Republican governor has been empowered to say, we're going to take positions that are pro-business. That's been the language for a lot of different issues this session, including about labor legislation and rules about discrimination laws. This is seen as a pro-business step to keep that minimum wage at $7.70, and that's what seems to be at issue here.
But Kansas City is going ahead with a vote today to raise their minimum wage up to $10. Why bother if the new state law won't allow it?
Right. $10 right away, just about 2 weeks from today, and then up to $15 over the next 5 years. Interestingly enough, the city council already passed an ordinance raising the wage to $8.50 next month, up to $13 over the next 5 years. Why do it? The supporters say it's a matter of principle. It's important to send a message that this is what's necessary for a person to make a living wage. The support in Kansas City has come largely from the Southern Christian Leadership Conference of Kansas City and a number of other primarily African-American or organizations that serve low-income communities in the city. They say this is an important statement, and it might provide the basis for a broader statewide ballot initiative, which at this point is probably the only way to change state law.
Now, in St. Louis, proponents of the higher minimum wage are asking businesses to voluntarily keep the new $10 minimum so that all these workers who got a raise back in May aren't going to face a big salary cut. How is that effort going?
Well, in St. Louis, some businesses have said they'll be able to abide by that. Others have been a lot less certain, and I think that's true in Kansas City as well. It's a very confusing situation, Jeremy, because there's a city ordinance on the books, there's this pending vote, and then there's the very real possibility that whatever happens, it'll be resolved ultimately through litigation, challenges to whether state government can control local policy in this way, especially once an ordinance is already in place.
And there's also a question about whether there's going to be a statewide statewide referendum on this issue?
Well, there's talk about it. Nothing has been filed yet, but advocates are saying that a strong showing in Kansas City today would provide a pretty strong basis, in their view, for cranking up a statewide effort. Like I said, with Republican supermajorities in both the House and the Senate and a Republican governor who allowed this bill to become law without his signature, it does seem likely that that's the only way this will change at the state level.
That's Brian Ellison, host and contributor at KCUR in Kansas City, Missouri, where they are voting today on whether to at least try to raise the city's minimum wage to $10 an hour. Brian, thanks.
Thank you, Jeremy.
Will she move or won't she? Reniqua Allen is a New York writer who left readers hanging at the end of her recent opinion piece in the New York Times, in which she thinks out loud about how African-American millennials are moving from the North to the South, a region many of their grandparents fled in the Great Migration in the 1930s. And one reason, their grandparents may have fled, but the millennials can feel their presence there. But what will Reniqua do? Reniqua Allen's op-ed was titled, Racism is Everywhere, So Why Not Move South? She joins us from NPR's New York studios. And Reniqua, you're seeing this movement of Black millennials anecdotally, but there's some pretty solid research.
Yeah, I heard stories of people moving to the South. I knew many of my friends and colleagues were thinking about moving to the South. And I knew that some of it seemed to be economic, but some of it seemed to also be cultural, that something was drawing people to the South. And when I started thinking about this book that I'm writing about Black millennials and the American dream and just what the future meant, I looked at this research about where Black millennials were moving to. I was shocked to see this research that they were moving to the South, but I was even more shocked to find that white millennials and Asian millennials were moving to distinctly different places.
Well, talk more about that. You write, between 2000 and 2014, 61% of millennials moving to New York were white. So there's a movement of white millennials to New York. Only 9% of 18 to 29-year-olds moving into New York were Black in that time period. And the stats about them moving south are, you know, nationally, 82,000 Black millennials migrated south in 2014. That's census data. And many of them came from the Northeast, the Midwest, and the West. They are settling in the South.
Yeah, it's kind of crazy, but I guess not so crazy when you look at young Black culture. Like for me, after I saw those statistics and was kind of shocked, I thought about what was happening in popular culture. I thought about my favorite new shows on television. And those shows were Atlanta, which is based obviously in Atlanta by Donald Glover. I thought about Insecure, which was based in L.A. And then I thought about shows like Girls, which Lena Dunham, you know, writes and stars in. I thought about Broad City, which is incredibly funny and I love it. But these were all shows about white millennials looking for their American dream. Mm-hmm. They were centered in New York City, kind of the traditional space for creatives and writers and those type of folks. But the shows about Black millennials were centered outside of New York City, which was something that I think is reflective of in those statistics about Black millennials. And person after person that I spoke with said that New York was not the center of Black young life anymore, which is kind of shocking to me. You know, I grew up here. I love New York City. I grew up with Tupac and Biggie and Nas. And to see that this new culture that was based out of the South was emerging and has been, you know, for years, I had to take a step back and think about why I'd been so attracted to the North and why I was so hesitant to the South, and where I think that the best life that I can live, where's that located? And I'm not really sure anymore.
Well, you have some telling lines here. First of all, you say, for you, it was beginning to seem that Black millennial culture, the center of Black life and the idea of Black hope and opportunity, are now squarely located in the South. You know, I'm white, and when I'm in the South, it feels to me as if I'm seeing more integration, more African Americans in leadership roles or in jobs I don't see them in the North. And I can hear listeners saying, well, wait a minute, the Civil War, the Confederate flag, you know, what about racism? Talk about what you are hearing from other millennials and what you saw yourself when you went to the South.
Yeah, I think the hardest thing for me about the South, I think of the South, I see Confederate flags, I think of the Civil War. It's really hard for me to kind of get past that. I feel like I see more racism there, but when I really sat down to think of it, honestly, I felt more racism in the North.
Talk about a story you share about you're on the Fancy Dance Upper East Side and you go in to get an espresso.
Man, so the Upper East Side has continuously frustrated me. New York City frustrates me. I think it is a very segregated city. And I think you're right. You know, the South in some ways feels more integrated than the North. I live in a Black community. You know, I live in a town, Inglewood, New Jersey, which literally the town is separated by railroad tracks. And you have largely upper income whites on one side and working class and middle class Black people on the other side. And so one day I was walking on the Upper East Side, which is a space that I typically just don't feel welcomed by in general. I'm used to people following me in stores. You know, I am brown skin. I usually have my hair in some kind of afro, and I usually have big hoop earrings. And I walk inside this espresso bar, and the barista walks up to me and from behind the counter and says, "Are you sure you want an espresso?" I'm like, "Yeah, this is an espresso bar. Of course I want an espresso." And he kind of aggressively, like, reaches up and grabs a cup and says, "Do you know that it comes in this small cup?" And I'm like, "Yeah, oh, that's man. Why I wanted a cup of espresso." And, you know, I brushed it off and I sat there and I looked around the place, which was all white people, young teenagers, older people. Specifically, I sat at the bar and I watched what the barista, how he interacted with other customers. And I noticed he did not do that with anyone else. He never questioned anyone else's order. He never asked if they knew what size the cup was. And it just seemed like a racial microaggression. It's one of those things that I think I will never really know what this barista was thinking. You know, in New York City, I've never seen a Confederate flag, actually. You know, I haven't really encountered racism in such an explicit way. No one's ever called me the N-word. It's much more subtle. And that's what I was trying to convey, though I will say lots of readers wrote to me and said that they felt the same way on the Upper East Side, no matter if they were Black or white. So maybe I take it with a grain of salt. But it's the little things that frustrate you as a young Black person. It's this feeling of invisibility and you're not worth it. You know, once they start to pile on, at least for me, I'm starting to wonder if, hey, you know what? New York is just as bad as someone holding a Confederate flag. And that's what I found when I spoke with many of these young millennials.
Well, there's some other statistics that and research that you point to. The Southern Poverty Law Center says there's more hate groups in New York and Pennsylvania than there are in Georgia, Mississippi, Virginia. The list goes on. And you and some other young Blacks are saying to each other, the title of your piece, racism is everywhere, so why not move south? And the benefits. You met somebody, a young woman, a South Carolina native, who went back because instead of buying this $170,000 co-op, so it's probably a small place in a building with an 800-plus maintenance fee, she can now get a four-bedroom townhouse for $200,000 in a good school district for her young son. But there's something else. There's
right.
this cultural thing. You got to talk to your great aunt Dee, who I guess recently died at 99. And, you know, she had fled the South in the Great Migration. You went to the town she left and heard about the KKK and all those kinds of, you know, chilling, horrible things. But also she left roots there.
Right. And I think that's what the interesting thing to me about all of this was, that, you know, for years I'd heard that the South is cheaper. That's not a surprise at all. But this real connection to the South, this connection to this land, this real sense of home, it was also about the South being a quote-unquote Black Mecca. And it's interesting because for me, she said, yes, New York City has tons of Black people, but it felt like a Black community there in ways that it didn't in New York City. I think we don't have that connection in the North. I mean, for me, I went to Manning, South Carolina, where my family is from, and met up with this wonderful woman, Misha Witherspoon. My family's last name is Witherspoon. She was young. She was bright. You know, she was professional. And I kept sitting there saying, could this be me? You know, and I just felt this sense of connection, this shared history, this visibility that I think is harder for me to feel in some ways up here.
So, Reniqua, what are you going to do?
You know, I don't know. I think I'm trying to figure out what this idea of a promised land looks like and what that means to me. I don't know.
Reniqua Allen, New York-based writer, producer. Her upcoming book that she mentioned is It Was All a Dream, Black Millennials, Migration, and Mobility. We'll link you to her recent New York Times opinion piece at herenow.org. Reniqua, let us know what you do.
Thank you. I will.
Yesterday, we told you about an anti-diversity memo written by one of Google's engineers. It said there are biological differences between men and women that make men more suited to working in technology. It was posted for Google employees to read. Well, the engineer behind the memo, James Damore, has now been fired. And in an internal email, CEO Sundar Pichai wrote that portions of the original memo violated Google's code of conduct by advancing harmful gender stereotypes in the workplace. Supporters of Damore say he's being unfairly punished for voicing his opinions. Here to talk more about this is our weekly guide to the world of tech, Recode. Ed Lee is managing editor at Recode. He joins us from New York. Hi, Ed.
Hey.
And for people who haven't been following this story, remind us what Damore's memo said exactly.
Well, so the main thrust of his memo is that there's a lack of ideological diversity at Google, you know, which is a fair issue to debate. But then he sort of talked about as well how that's hurting other issues like gender diversity, and which he attributes to biology, that women, you know, for example, have higher levels of anxiety and are more inclined towards aesthetics than ideas, which is why you're probably seeing fewer women in tech.
Hmm. And Recode broke the news about Google's decision to fire Damore. What did the company's CEO have to say about it?
Well, so Sundar Pichai, as you pointed out that at the top of this, you know, he basically said it crossed the line, and that, you know, the reason why he was focusing on Damore's position that, you know, biology is a factor here, and that's a gender stereotype, and he says you're furthering that, and there's no place for that in our company, and he was fired.
What does all this mean for Google, which, as we know, prides itself on being creative and allowing its employees to think critically and speak their minds?
Well, that's a great point. The whole Silicon Valley conceit for the past 20 years plus, you know, the age of the internet, that, you know, ideas want to be free, the information wants to be free. That's the conceit, and that's what drew a lot of people like Damore into the field. So they're not creating widgets. They're saving the world, or they're making the world a better place. So you're going to inevitably have people like Damore sort of, you know, put out their positions. And there's a lot of people at Google who agree with him, frankly, not just at Google, but in Silicon Valley. So it's a bigger issue than this one memo that sort of was distributed.
Is he likely to sue Damore?
Yeah. So he said in some reports that he's pursuing legal options. You know, these cases, you know, sort of can get into the legal weeds. You know, there's a chance he does have a case here if, you know, he was fired, you know, outside of the usual purview of his workplace. And, you know, it's not like he was necessarily sexually harassing someone. Of course, it was just his ideas, his thoughts. So this is going to drag on.
And just as this news was coming out, Google announced that it had hired a diversity VP, Danielle Brown. What do we know about her?
So we don't know too much. She had a similar role at Intel prior to this. And, you know, of course, as her title states, it's to boost diversity. So, you know, at Google right now, looking specifically at women, one in five women within the technology field, one in five are women. In the leadership field, it's one in four. Hmm. Now, Intel, so that's not great, certainly, and so you want to improve that. But at Intel, where Brown hails from, the ratio is about the same or slightly worse. You know, in the leadership ranks at Intel, it's one in five as opposed to one in four. So, you know, it's diversity is always a tough thing when you're hiring. You always want the best people for the job, but then you also want to be aware of gender and race as a factor. It's a balancing act, but, you know, no one's really proven any real methods towards achieving that. So, you know, she has, you know, work cut out for her.
While we have you, Ed, there's another story in the tech and media world. Hackers released a number of stolen files from HBO and are threatening to release even more. What's going on here?
So this was basically a, you know, what we call a ransomware attack. You know, the hackers compromised the account of an HBO executive and threatened to leak the info from that account unless HBO paid up. So this was entirely mercenary.
And there's like Game of Thrones scripts in there and things like that?
Game of Thrones scripts, even full episodes in some cases, as well as, you know, contact information for people in entertainment industry that HBO works with. So a lot of sensitive information.
Not as big, though, as the 2014 Sony hack.
It wasn't. I mean, the Sony hack was different in that it was purely about, you know, trying to embarrass or hurt Sony specifically. And based on our reporting at the time that we knew North Korea was behind it, you know, they had taken umbrage at a film that Sony was producing that basically satirized the nation. So, but in either case, though, it's whether it's mercenary or political, it's a direct attack. And I think that's, you know, that's the key here is that, you know, HBO is a media company. They don't produce widgets. They produce bits. They produce information ultimately, right? And that's subject to these kinds of things.
And why would you want to read the Game of Thrones script before the show comes out? It just hurts you.
I don't get it either.
I don't get it. Ed Lee, managing editor at Recode. Thanks so much, as always.
Anytime.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.